Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ben Bland. I'm the new director of the Southeast Asia project at the Lowy Institute. And I'm delighted to be joined today by a very special guest who's back at Lowy for the second time, I believe, Professor Dewi Fortuna Anwar, who is over to discuss the upcoming Indonesian elections and some of the challenges to democracy in Indonesia. And I should say that Professor Dewi is here with the kind support of the Australia-ASEAN Council of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, which has helped us put together a program of ASEAN visiting fellows, of which Dewi is the first. And we have more to come later this year from Malaysia and Thailand. So keep a close watch on our website, as I'm sure you do already. So before we get into the meaty, complex issues, I just want to try and set the scene for those of you who aren't following Indonesian politics as much as the two of us for our sins. So 3 weeks from now, as you may have seen from some of the stats that were on screen, 193 million Indonesians are going to be voting for their president, the parliament, the upper house and the lower house, and various local and provincial legislatures. And it's one of the most complex and complicated single-day elections the world has ever seen. So there's more than 245,000 candidates up for election on one day, running for 20,000 different seats, 6 million election workers, more than the population of Denmark, and they'll be overseeing 805,000 polling stations spread across thousands of islands. The materials, the ink that people dip their fingers into afterwards is halal certified, and all these materials, thousands of ballot papers, have to be carried up rivers on canoes, cars, probably horse and cart in some places. It's a huge logistical effort. But of course, the big race that everyone wants to talk about is the presidential election. And this year, we have the incumbent, President Joko Widodo, known as Jokowi, facing off against Prabowo Subianto, who challenged him last time and lost in 2014. It's a replay of the last election. And looking at the polls, most recent ones out in the last couple of days, there's a big poll lead for Jokowi of something like 15 or more percentage points. He also has all the advantages of incumbency. So many of the political parties are lining up behind him, as well as a lot of the provincial governors. So looking at all the obvious data and the historical precedent, it looks good for Jokowi. But of course, we've had a lot of election surprises all around the world, from Brexit in my sorry country to Trump, to Malaysia, just next door, to Indonesia. So, Dewi, I know that technically as a civil servant employed by Indonesia's sort of primary research institution, you can't express personal political views in terms of what you want to do. But why don't you start by telling us about the candidates? Tell us a bit about Jokowi and Prabowo. Who are they, and what are the differences between these two contenders for leadership of the world's fourth biggest country?
Well, firstly, thank you very much to the Lowy Institute and Ben for inviting me to come here a second time. And I didn't realize that I'm the first ASEAN Australia fellow, visiting fellow, you know, from the invited by Lowy and DFAT. So I'm truly honored, and it's always lovely to be here in Sydney. Although unfortunately we are sitting here, not outside, enjoying. But thank you very much for coming. Most of you probably know very well who Jokowi and Prabowo are, but for some of you who might not have been following Indonesian politics too closely, Joko Widodo, remember, once upon a time, he was a furniture businessman, small-town businessman from a small town called Solo. This is the heartland of Java, not too far from Yogyakarta. And then he ran to become the mayor of Solo, and actually transform this very sleepy little town into a vibrant town within 5 years. You know, he was able to make it into a very, very interesting, dynamic civic center as well as dynamic economic center. For those of you who have been to Solo, I used to remember, you know, how sleepy it was. Nothing was happening, you know, compared to Jogja. But then Jokowi made pedestrians, you might think it's odd, but in Indonesia, to have actually pedestrians where you can walk, it's quite amazing. And he was able to remove hawkers from streets and put them in a place where they could both do their business and make it into an attractive tourist center. So he became a hope for a lot of younger civil society groups who were very tired of the usual politicians from Jakarta, other former military generals or, you know, blue blood party families or businessmen, big businessmen who are all Jakarta based. So he was very much an outlier in 2014, and he was brought in. Before that, he was when Jakarta was going to change its governor. I think that was in 2009 or something. Jokowi was brought in to contest the election in Jakarta, which everybody thought at the time was very unlikely because he was facing the incumbent, who was a native Jakartan, Fauzi Wibowo, supported by all the major political parties, and Joko Widodo was a real nobody at the time, you know, not connected to big families or to the fat military or to any of the bureaucracy of political parties. And then he won the Jakarta election. He ran with Basuki Cahayapurnama, you know, the first an ethnic Chinese and Christian to become the vice governor of Jakarta. And not long after that, he was successful as governor of Jakarta. Before he completed his term, he was nominated with great difficulty to run for the 2014 election. He was nominated by the PDIP, basically. But Ibu Megawati at the PDIP at the time was not that keen to nominate him because she was still thinking of running herself. But they calculated that if she ran, she would lose. So they nominated Jokowi. So he was, at that time, not really that backed by the party machinery. He really won on the backs of civil society, a lot of young people, rock bands, and things like that. Now, Prabowo Subianto was, of course, has a very interesting background. His father is an Indonesian prominent economist, Sumitro Joyohadikusumo, who was the architect of the New Order economic policy. So, you know, a very strong intellectual background there, actually. But his father-in-law is even better known. His father-in-law was President Suharto. So he was his last position as a three-star general, head of KOSTRA, that's a strategic reserves. He was in special unit, the Kopassus. That is like the special unit of the Indonesian army. He has a very checkered record. He was fired from the military after the fall of Suharto, being accused of being implicated in a number of the disappearance of democracy activists. So he ended his career, in fact, before his proper retirement age. But then he became a businessman. For a while, he went to live in Jordan. He's a classmate of King Abdullah of Jordan, so he spent quite a number of years in Jordan. His brother, Hashim Joyohadikusumo, is a major businessman. He's very well connected, like the former governor of Bank Indonesia, Sudrajat Jiwandono, his brother-in-law. His family is very pluralistic. His mother is a Christian. His father is a Muslim. He's a Muslim, but most of his family is actually Christians. So comes from a very interesting family background. But then when Indonesia tends to have rather, as you know, short-term memory, and we thought that, you know, it would be difficult for him to come back. But in 2014, he was nominated to run for president. And in fact, he lost very, very small margin. So, you know, so this backed, you know, with this interesting, very pluralistic background, Prabowo seems to be the favored candidate by most of the hardline Muslim groups.
So I'm going to hog Dewi for about half an hour more, and then I'll open up the floor to your questions. So, I mean, going back to Jokowi the outsider, like a lot of other leaders who sweep to power on a wave of hope from young people and activists, he very quickly disappointed all those people. So, what are they disappointed about? Why are they, the activists, the human rights activists in particular, so upset with Jokowi now? Is that the inevitable transformation from the outsider to the insider and the compromises you have to make to survive in politics?
Well, it's always, you know, you are only an idealist when you don't have power. Once you get to power, you get bogged down by the reality of the business that you have to deal with. Joko Widodo, I mean, maybe it was a misplaced expectations because Joko himself is a product of this democratic transition. Without Indonesian democratization, it is not possible for somebody, a civilian, not connected to any military families or you know, political parties or big business, and from somebody really, really, you know, not really in the capital, to be able to win in Jakarta. It was just not happening. So he is the product of the new Indonesia. So people just assume that as a product of a new Indonesia, he will be totally imbued with all of the values and so on. But remember that Jokowi is never a student activist. He never fought with a student movement for the Reformasi movement. He never really was, you know, involved in the various Reformasi agenda about democratizations and so on and so forth. So he never promised he would, because in his campaign promise, he was concerned about social welfare, economic issues, infrastructure, and so on. And he delivered on that. In fact, that is one of his most important achievements, is that if you go to Jakarta and Indonesia now, there are a lot of infrastructure projects are being developed. And in terms of the social welfare, health, in fact, Indonesia has one of the most ambitious universal healthcare programs for education and so on. That's really working. But social activists, democracy activists, who hope that he would deal with past human rights abuses, that he would actually take all of those generals, many of whom are now helping him in the cabinet, to court, you know, that didn't materialize. And all of the other issues that he would be willing to champion, you know, rights of minorities. I'm not sure that he's against it. It's just not his primary focus. So they're a bit disappointed, you know. So incumbents tend to be, you know, either you are successful and in everything, and people really like you and hope better things from you, or because they have such a high expectation, they can only be disappointed. But I think that Jokowi has delivered on a lot of things, but he's been a disappointment on a number of things as well.
Yeah, for those of you who haven't been to Jakarta, the city has just got its first ever MRT line, first ever metro line, which is quite an achievement after something like 40 years of failed efforts to get it. And finally, under Jokowi, but not only due to him, it's finally come to fruition, which is quite amazing to see. And he's obviously been milking it on social media for political purposes, as well you might in an election season. So I want to drill a bit deeper into some of the concerns about democracy in Indonesia, and particularly talk about this question of identity politics, which seems to be exercising so many societies all around the world. Certainly not something unique to Indonesia, but it's an issue that's really cropped up quite sharply in the last few years. And just 2 or 3 years ago, in this very heated contest to re-elect the governor of Jakarta, Jokowi's ally and his former deputy governor, Basuki Cahayapurnama, otherwise known as Ahok, at least before, but anyway. Ahok was a Chinese, he was a Christian, a double minority in Indonesia, and he was effectively ousted from office and then prosecuted and jailed for blasphemy at the same time. And that was partly the result of a sort of ground-up movement from hardline Islamist groups and conservative Muslim clerics who wanted to get rid of him for political and religious purposes. And that seemed to be a very divisive election. After that, many people said, once Ahok is out the way, everything will be fine again, because you can't have identity politics between Muslims, only, you know, Muslims versus other religions, or, you know, supposed native Indonesians against Chinese Indonesians, although they're obviously native too, in fact. But actually what we've seen is that the identity politics issue hasn't gone away, and those same sort of hardline groups and conservative forces seem to have moved the mainstream of Indonesian politics, the so-called nationalist parties, down a much more Islamic path. And before, we had Prabowo associating with hardline clerics, and Jokowi is the champion of pluralists. Now, confusingly, it's switched. So Jokowi has as his vice presidential candidate a conservative aging cleric who's been a champion of intolerance against the LGBT community, religious minorities. And now Prabowo says he's distanced himself from the hardliners, and he's standing up for human rights. So what's going on, firstly, with this identity politics question? You know, it seems so confusing, but at the core, what is the problem, and how worried should we be about about the direction of this identity politics and its implications for democracy in Indonesia?
Well, that's a very big question. I think that's a whole PhD thesis there.
Well, I'll give you 5 minutes.
All right. Well, I think we need to set context, yeah, because Indonesia, as you know, is very, very plural. You know, we have all of the major religions in Indonesia and different ethnic groups, racial groups, and so on. And throughout the New Order period under Suharto, there's a very strict law that you are not allowed to discuss what is called sara, suku, that's ethnicity, agama, that's religion, antar golongan, that's class, and the other one is race, yeah, race. So it's forbidden by law to discuss about this identity issues in public. You can go to jail. Newspapers cannot write about it. And clearly, you know, there's no social media where you can circulate things like that. Now, so harmonious relations between the various groups were enforced through coercive means, put it that way. Now, once the New Order government was swept aside, Indonesia entered a new democratic era. You can talk about anything. It's called freedom of speech, which is protected by the constitution. That means you can also talk about identity issues. So this is not new. When in the people did not pay attention so much in the general elections because it don't become an issue in the general elections when the first presidential election was SBY and it's just, you know, it's always a mixture of secular nationalists and religious nationalists. But if you look at the regional elections, the issues of identities had been played out, particularly in the eastern part of Indonesia and then in Kalimantan. In Kalimantan, the issue of Dayak versus Malays. In Maluku, the issues of Christianity, Christians versus Muslims. In Papua, the issues of Orang Papua Asli, you know, real Papuans and migrants from outside. So this already became an issue, and the central government was already very rather concerned about that. So, you know, how to balance it. But in Indonesian politics, it became toxic in the run-up to the 2017 election, because when Ahok, the Chinese Christian vice governor, was running as the second one with Jokowi, attention was to Jokowi, not to Ahok. But when Jokowi ran to become president, it was very clear from the very beginning that a lot of the more hardline groups were not willing to accept him. And I know this for a fact because I work with the vice president in the Kebun, you know, Jalan Merdeka, and at the back is Kebun Siri. Next door to it is the town hall and the Jakarta legislature. Every Friday, absolutely, after every Friday prayer, there'll be groups of people demonstrating against Ahok from day one that he took over from governor. One of their objections is that one of the roles of a governor is to chair a lot of councils and meetings and preside of prayers and things like that, because you know, there are a lot of religious prayers as well. And Ahok, being a minority, he was not able to attend any of these things. And so they issued, they look at Quran and say, you know, is it allowed for non-Muslims to be led by for Muslims to be led by non-Muslims? So a lot of them were already coming out against him. In fact, at one point, I had to get out of my car because there's huge demonstrations on that side of the road. So this is prior, you know, so this was already starting in 2014. So, and then it was quite clear that a lot of these people were not going to be happy to let him run again or to win. But Ahok was very popular. He was very effective as a governor. He fought against corruption. He was tough against, you know, rule breakers. So he was loved by a lot of activists, but hated by a lot of people who he evicted. He tried to clear the river sites and things like that. So he was a very controversial figure. But the worst thing about him was that he never minded his tongue. You know, he always shot straight from the hip, and he often got into trouble. So he offended a lot of people. So when he mentioned something that could be construed to be regarded by some groups that it was insulting Islam, it became an issue, as you know, and he was huge. There were demonstrations against him, but it was played out as an insult against Islam. So it was the huge demonstrations in Jakarta that culminated in the 2 December 2016, that came the name, the 212 movement, were really, really hundreds of thousands gathered around, you know, the central Monas area. They came from all over Indonesia, so not just from Jakawi. And they were able, you know, to put pressure on Ahok, and, you know, and that's when you said the chairman of the religious council is Ma'ruf Amin, whose expert opinion actually, you know, helped to convict Ahok of blasphemy, because he was asked by the prosecutors, you know, whether his statement that he made was considered to be blasphemous or not. And that the chairman of the Ulama Council statement said, you know, it was considered to be blasphemous. And that, in fact, you know, that led to Ahok being convicted. He still ran for the election, but the ticket lost because of the public opinions against him. And then he was jailed, as you know. Now, from that time, you could really see that Jokowi is considered to be, although he did not really protect Ahok, he could not really intervene in the legal process. But
some would say he sacrificed it. Yeah, not just he couldn't intervene, he chose not to, right? That's the criticism.
Well, but on the other hand, you know, how what could he have done? Because if he had intervened, he would have been considered to be intervening. Because it was taken, you know, it was in the court. The president can only intervene in a matter when you're already pronounced guilty, and then you ask for amnesty. And then the president constitutionally can give you, you know, an amnesty. But Ahok did not choose to do that. He chose to go to jail and have done with it. But, you know, so Jokowi is damned either way. Those who said that Jokowi could have done something were disappointed. But I said, you know, what could he have done? But those who said that Jokowi was associated with Ahok, that is the narrative that's continued to be played out. So the 212 group said, you know, we will try to do the same thing because they already supported Prabowo anyway. And that was, I think, the genesis of the more toxic issues. But at the same time, a lot of this identity politics also fabricated, because the government uncovered, for example, during the 2017, at least, you know, two groups, this is Muslim Cyber Army and Saracen, that actually fabricated this endless hoax and fake news, and capturing the Facebook accounts of a lot of people, and so that, you know, it went viral. So this is also an issue for our modern age of media, social media, where you really don't know, you know, what is true and what is not true, and that segregates very, very quickly, especially with a lot of people with a lot of time in their hands, like housewives and pensioners and civil servants and so on. You know,
they
people in think tanks. They just distribute things. So this becomes, you know, very, very, very unsettling.
But is there a deeper societal change behind this? I mean, surely this isn't just fake news. I mean, presumably the reason that Jokowi has recruited the guy who destroyed his ally as his vice president is because he thinks there is a real social change in Indonesia, and people want figures who are somehow more Islamic or reflect a more conservative view of the religion. And if he's not able to do that, he presumably needs this cleric as his shield.
He could have chosen anybody else. You know, I think the choice that fell on Ma'ruf Amin did surprise everybody, because people expected somebody else. And then why Yusuf Kalla was elected as vice president to Joko Widodo is not only because he was experienced in government, but also because he's the chairman of the mosque council, and also respected religious leader. So it's always the case in Indonesia. Jokowi is seen to come from a more, you might, Abangan background, you know, less santri, less religious background, and PDIP historically, because this is Sukarno's party, has always been seen to be secular nationalist and more associated with, you know, the nominal Muslims background. So, and usually they always try to find a balanced tickets. Because remember, when Megawati ran for presidency, her first vice president was Hamzah Has, the chairman of the United Development Party, the chairman of an Islamist party. So this is not something terribly new, you know. But the temper is different. Now, you're going to ask, Is it something systemic and so on, or is it instrumental? I don't know. Because religiosity is on the increase in Indonesia, if just by the, how people express themselves, you know, people are very openly expressing, you know, I'm a Muslim, and there's also a hijrah movement. So you see more people, you know, they...
Maybe you can explain what that is.
Briefly. Yeah, so apparently hijrah referred to the Prophet's time when moving from Mecca to Medina, developing this Islamic community. But now there's in Indonesia also a movement, and apparently this is mostly among young people with very little religious Islamic training. So, you know, not people who are deeply educated in religion, among K-pop fans and things like that. And suddenly they, through their social medias, and because people don't really read things, so they watch things on YouTube and the call for hijrah to become more Muslim. And suddenly, yesterday they were watching Pinks, and now, you know, suddenly, you know, they cover themselves. Now, I don't know whether this is something substantive or whether it's just another thing, like a fad. I think the jury is still out about that. But yeah, people are more religious. But in terms of politics, Islamic politics are not doing well. And then they've never really done well in Indonesian politics. So when it comes to votes in, and you know, whether it's for parliament and so on, political parties that are Islamic political parties have never done really well. The peak of the party's performance was in 1955, and they've never really got that ground even until the present day. And so you can really say, you know, on the one hand, people are becoming more religious, there's a rise of intolerance, but it is not reflected in their behavior in the polls. Because as I said, Islamist parties are very divided, and they don't do well, and among others, because many of the chairmen of parties have been arrested in corruption charges, and people tend to get very more disappointed, you know, if secular parties or parties that headed by former military people got involved in corruption. We said, oh, okay, you know. But when religious leaders who chair parties were supposed to be much more morally abiding, and they got arrested, and then people tend to punish the parties more.
And is part of the explanation for the reason why the Islamist political parties can't increase their vote, because then so-called nationalist parties like Jokowi's PDIP, Prabowo's Gerindra, Golkar, the former vehicle of, you know, from the Suharto era, because they have incorporated more Islamist policies in their platforms and a more Islam religion-friendly stance. And so they don't need to vote for Islamist parties now because they can get, you know, similar policies and a similar viewpoint from the so-called nationalist or secular parties.
Yeah, but as I said, in Indonesia, we have no such thing as secular party. Pancasila is not secular ideology, because belief in God is a constitutional mandate in Indonesia. I think we have to understand this. When people talk about secularism, there's no such thing as a secular Indonesia, because it is not allowed. It is un-Indonesian to claim yourself to be an atheist. You have to have a religion.
You can go to jail.
You can go to jail, you know, because and that was from the beginning. Because, and there's a history to that, because of this deep division before independence between the communists and the Islamic groups. The Islamic parties wanted an Islamic state in Indonesia. The Communist Party, of course, you know, wanted something else. And then the secular nationalists wanted a completely secular state. So the compromise was to have Pancasila, which is a pluralist ideology, where you are free to have your own religion, but you have to have a religion. It doesn't, it doesn't say, you know, you have to pray five times per day, or you have to go to church every Sunday. It just say that on, you know, on your identity, you have to have a religion. So all parties, if you are, you know, a more secular nationalist, i.e. not Islamic based, you'll always want to quote the Islamic votes. The Islamist groups, they always have to quote the nationalist votes as well, because these are the true main pillars of Indonesian society. So that is why Indonesian politics usually have avoided going to extremes. You cannot win votes if you take very, very secular, you know, anti-religious position, or if you take a very, very religious position and not thinking about Pancasila and national unity. That's why in most elections, parties that win has always been the one in the middle. And the mixed tickets are very common. especially in mixed societies like in Maluku, where they have more equal number of Christians and Muslims. If you have a governor who is a Christian, his vice governor would always be somebody who is a prominently acknowledged as a Muslim, and vice versa. If you have a prominent Muslim, then you'll have, you know, a Christian. So, but a lot of the political parties, as I said, you know, they are using religion instrumentally. And that is why a lot of civil society groups and democracy activists are saying, you know, they're often, quite often, it's not so much the deep societal demand, but it is like carrying favor to political action committees, you know, to pressure groups, and they're very instrumental about it. But it is a dangerous game that you can play.
And in terms of that game, there have been quite a few studies recently by leading academics of Indonesian Islam looking at Ma'ruf Amin, this 76-year-old conservative who's, you know, championed intolerance against non-Muslims and even Muslim sects and non-mainstream groups. And looking at, they're worried about what he might do as the vice president if Jokowi, the front runner, wins. So how worried should we be? I mean, some people say it might see Indonesia move towards a more Malaysia-style system where not only is it a religious society, but, you know, Islam gets hard-baked into the political system and the legal system. So should we be worried about Ma'ruf Amin as vice president? I mean, I ask because you've worked with two vice presidents in their offices before, so you have a very clear picture, Dewi, of what the VP in Indonesia can actually do, and I guess perhaps more importantly, what they can't.
Mostly what they can't. I mean, Pak Budiono once, you know, I worked in the vice president's office from 2010, 2017 with Vice President Budiono, Vice President Jeka, and Vice President Budiono used to joke, you know, people ask me what the vice president does. I also wonder, you know, what I do myself. What the president can do, it depends very much on what the president allows him to do. And it depends on the trust between the two. Now, I may be wrong, but you're right that I've got a feeling that Ma'ruf Amin was forced onto Jokowi to become his VP, which is not his first choice. If you remember, before Ma'ruf Amin was announced, it was everybody thought that it was the former chairman of the Constitutional Court, also a prominent religious figure, but mostly known as a constitutional expert, Mahfud MD, and civil society groups and people who are concerned about continuing democratic consolidation, so it's quite happy to have him, despite the fact that he's prominent, you know, as a Muslim leader. And why not? You know, because I have written that Indonesian democracy is underpinned by major Islamic groups and consensus about Pancasila. Because if major Islamic groups in Indonesia did not want Indonesia to be a pluralist democracy, it would not have happened. And the fact of the matter is that Indonesia is a democratic pluralist society, despite all the challenges. But and I say, you know, Ma'ruf Amin is the vice president. And precisely, mostly because he's old enough not to be seen as a threat by other Islamic figures who want to run in 2024. But what could he do as a vice president? I got a feeling that not much, because President Joko Widodo tends to be a very hands-on president and gives very little to the vice president. While SBY gave a lot of responsibility to Vice President Jeka in his first cabinet, but that caused a lot of, you know, contending rivalry, two sons kind of things. So he appointed Budiono, who is very low-keyed, but gave him a lot of work to do, but did not really allow him to be too visible. Now, with Joko Widodo, he appointed Jeka because somebody with a lot of government experience, a lot of network in politics and society as well. But from very beginning, a very limited mandate, put it that way, because a lot of things are being done, not by the vice president's office, but by the president's office. So I imagine that if Jokowi are to win the next election, the vice president would also be given very, very limited remit. So maybe, on the other hand, you know, we might see that he would lead more on the efforts towards de-radicalizations, because in the last presidential debate where the vice president was there, he was able to be quite convincing in quoting chapters of the Quran against extremism and so on. And we do need that, because when we are talking to groups that are, you know, very strong in their view about jihad and so on, it's very difficult for somebody who is not as well versed in the Quranic chapters and the teachings to argue with them. So somebody like Ma'ruf Amin can actually quote chapters and verse and say, you know, this is wrong, this is not Islamic, and so on. So he could be quite effective in that.
Okay. Before we talk about the VPN anymore, I want to move on to foreign policy briefly before we open up to your questions. So just two quick things, really, I guess. The first is about increasing strategic competition in Asia between the US and China. I mean, Indonesia finds itself in many ways in a similar position to Australia, right? Doing a lot of trade with China, but in a certain respect, not a treaty partner, but relying on that security relationship with the US, and really the US as a check against maybe China's more aggressive intentions geopolitically in the region. So how is Indonesia gonna balance this increase in competition going forward? In the past, Indonesia has maintained this sort of free and active foreign policy, but it seems to me that's gonna be harder and harder when you have, you know, both China and the US demanding, you know, much more assertively that you pick sides.
Well, you know, we've been through this before. After all, you know, it's not that long ago that the Cold War ended, where countries were being forced to pick. And that was precisely why Indonesia decided to have this independent and active foreign policy and, you know, to co-found the Non-Aligned Movement to try to find more space for, you might say, you know, the middle power countries. So that relevance of this standpoint of being free and active and being neither, you know, not being allied to either side, but engaging with both sides, I think it's going to be even more relevant. And Indonesia seems to be doing that. At the same time, Indonesia is also trying to be more active now in this constructive role of regional cooperation. So as you know, Indonesia is now at the moment spearheading this draft on an ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific concept. So there's so many different concepts around that. You know, there's the US, the Japanese, and the Chinese with the VI and so on. So Indonesia said, you know, because physically ASEAN countries are right in the middle geographically, so we have to be able to play a more active geostrategic role in managing these relations as well. So this is the issues that ASEAN must again step up to the plate, and Indonesia proposed that ASEAN continues to be the fulcrum of every activities based on ASEAN-led mechanisms like the East Asia Summit, not just in providing, you know, the forum for discussions to build habits of dialogues, but also to look at the different initiatives on the ground, not rejecting them, by looking at the offers made by China, by India, by Japan, and see where we can find commonalities, and then use ASEAN, you know, mechanisms to look to be as the interface for that. So that means, you know, engaging all sides without fear or favor, and not being allowing any one party to become too dominant. And I said, you know, we have always been able to hedge, you know, strategic hedging after all, you know. And I say the difference is Australia is, of course, a formal ally of the US. So the room to maneuver is less for Australia than for Indonesia, which is already a non-aligned country.
So you'd recommend the Australians to cut America loose?
No, not really. I mean, there is a place for hard realists. So as I say, you know, ASEAN countries and Indonesia have enjoyed, you know, have benefited from this. But clearly, we do not want to see the rivalry to harden, you know, so we need to create space for the cooperation. But the real hard power reality, you still need it. You know, we are, you know, there is a parallel universe, a universe of cooperation, but there's also a real universe of competition. What we need to avoid is conflict. You know, we can always benefit from a bit of rivalry because it gives attention to us.
And just lastly, I want to ask a bit more about Indonesia's regional role in protecting Muslims in Asia, because the Indonesian government's been very outspoken, well, not just in Asia, but more broadly, about, you know, the Palestine issue and standing up for the rights of the Palestinians. They've been very outspoken about the Rohingya, the Muslim minority in Myanmar, and the way that the government is, you know, carrying out a genocide against them, but almost nothing on Xinjiang. You know, the Chinese autonomous, in theory, region where something like a million Uyghur Muslims are detained in these re-education camps. So why is Indonesia happy to speak out about the Rohingya, about Palestine, but says almost nothing about Xinjiang? I mean, is that the limits in a way of Indonesia's ability to push back against a more assertive China?
Firstly, I think we need to clarify about Palestine. Palestine is not an Islamic issue, although it is perceived that Indonesia had always supported independent state of Palestine since the early days of independence. So for the government, it is just a matter of unfinished decolonization issues. Although the wider Muslim community may see that more as an Islamic sensitive issues, but I think that it is not seen as that. So it's been there from the very beginning. The Rohingya issues, Indonesia was in the beginning a bit careful because of this principle of non-interference in each other's internal affairs. But the Rohingya issue impinged directly on the security of Southeast Asia as a whole because of this forced migration issues. And it also led not just to human tragedy, but also concerns about security. Because a number of the Rohingyas, of course, also became vulnerable, not just to human trafficking, but also to radicalizations and so on. So it became hard security, non-traditional security issues. You cannot ignore it. And in fact, that's why Indonesia has been very active in not just individually, but also in ASEAN to deal with this matter. Now, the Xinjiang issue is a bit problematic. Firstly, because Indonesia itself is always very wary about this interfering in the domestic affairs of other countries. It doesn't like it when other countries interfere in its domestic affairs. As I said, within Rohingya, it was something because it was so horrible. And to your face, you couldn't really ignore it. And civil societies and Islamic groups became very agitated about this as well. They were demonstrating in front of the Burmese embassies and things like that. Now, on the Xinjiang issues, the Islamic groups have taken up these issues. They have been critical. If you read the Republica and so on, they have been putting a lot of pressures. The government, as I said, there are two issues here. There are reluctance to go too much because of being accused of interfering in Chinese domestic affairs. And I think, I think Wuhan has to be honest on this as well. Or maybe concerns of angering China and then affecting, business relations. But here again, this is problematic. And that's why the government has also come under a lot of criticisms that you need to take a bit more courage when on matters of principles. And also, it also means that, we have to be much more open also to external criticisms on issues where we should be criticized. I'm of the opinion, I'm a member of the new school of Indonesian, academics and also government. I believe that ASEAN should be more open, because we are all very, very responsible for the human rights of our neighborhood as well. And Indonesia, in fact, took the lead in forcing Myanmar to open up. So in this case, this is clearly a problem.
And in the spirit of the new school of openness, I'm now happy to take your questions. Please do identify yourself, give your name and your affiliation.
Hi, I'm Anjali Bakon from the Australia-Indonesia Youth Association. So you might recall in February, Jokowi made allegations of foreign consultants being engaged in meddling in the election campaign, which led to strenuous denials by the Russian embassy and Prabowo's campaign team. How substantive were these allegations in terms of foreign interference in the election process? Or do you just think this was a campaign attack that was subtly trying to undermine Prabowo? Thank you.
That sounds like a political question to me. So, but at the time there were these allegations because there was, I think somebody was mentioned, that the role of this foreign person in devising the campaign and so on. Clearly, Indonesia also have very strict regulations about what is allowed and what is not allowed. So the Prabowo group clearly said, that's not true. The Jokowi group said, that the allegation is true. But what is true, though, is that the allegations by the General Elections Commissions, that they were worried that the Chinese and the Russians were hacking their system. And that's probably true because the problem that happened in the US and so on. So, they need to be much more alert about their cybersecurity. But clearly it's also part of political. I don't think it was fabricated as such, but I don't really think that's true either, that the foreigners are involved.
I'm David Reeve from the University of New South Wales. I used to know your dad 40 years ago.
Yeah. Well, now he makes me feel younger.
One aspect of this election is the higher electoral threshold when the parties are elected, and it looks like a number of long-standing parties may be wiped out at this election. So I wondered if you'd comment a bit on what sort of different sort of party system, different pattern we'll see in Parliament after this election.
Yeah. Well, as you know, we have a presidential system, and it is not normal in a presidential system to have such large number of political parties. Like in the US, you only have really two parties, although there are a lot of other independent things.
There are 16 now contesting the national elections in Indonesia.
Now in Indonesia, now there are 16. There have been attempts to, you know, to reduce the numbers of parties because it is really not effective if you have so many parties in the parliament and many of them with barely enough members to sit in all the different commissions. So, you know, we said, you know, it should be better to have a smaller number of parties so that they would really be effective in it. People keep they keep making new parties. So a lot of the parties have disappeared. You know, remember 48 parties in 99 elections? And after that, you know, God knows how many, and the last one it's about 9 parties in parliament, I think. And now, you know, 16 parties contending. Maybe the ones that were really earn votes will be about 5 or 6, and some of the established parties would probably lose. You know, is it better or worse? Well, some argue that this is not terribly democratic because it leads to a few oligarchic parties. Others would say it's probably better for representations because if your parties are not going to be that influential, you're not really able, you know, to channel your aspirations through your MPs who are not really able to sit in different commissions. So if it's, what is it now, 10%?
Is it? It's 4%. 4%, so,
yeah.
So parties need to get 4% nationwide to qualify for winning constituency votes.
Yeah, yeah. So they said that only about 5 or 6 parties. But I'm sure that they will make new parties again, you know, because some parties have, new parties have done well. Democratic Party, the SBY, made one, you know, quite big in 2004. It started with a very small party and then it won quite substantive votes in 2014. Now it's gone down again. Gerindra didn't exist before and now, you know, it's gone up. So we'll probably see ups and downs. You know, new parties will continue to come about with new personalities.
Yeah, the path pattern was if you didn't succeed in getting selected, like Prabowo as the candidate for Golkar, you went off and formed your own party instead.
Yes. if one looks at it, the one party that really have its core constituent is the PDIP, where because it originated from the Sukarno's PNI, so they have a hardcore of loyalists. While the others, they're happy travelers, put it that way. But there will be a core of about, I don't know, about 9 to 10%. While the Islamic parties, very few hardcore loyalists because they're so spread out. Because there's only one Mashumi, from the Mashumi party of 1950s. They all wanted to become members of the cabinet. And if you become a chairman of party and your party even only wins about 2 votes, 2 members of parliament, there's a likelihood that you'll be brought into the cabinet. So a lot of people, they just wanted to become chair, president of their party so that they can join the cabinet.
Hi, Elaine Pearson from Human Rights Watch. You talked a lot about the role of Islam in politics, and I wanted to know what are your thoughts about the proliferation of these bylaws sort of sweeping across Indonesia, forcing women to wear the hijab, the veil, and I guess how do you see the role post-election of a central government, I guess, in trying to push back against some of these local decrees?
Well, it is a worrying issue when a lot of, regional governments pass by laws that are discriminatory towards women. In some areas, there have been successful pushback, both from local civil society and also if it really violates what you might call CEDAW, you know, Convention on Elimination Against Discrimination of Women, then the government could be quite effective. I remember in West Sumatra, the Padang administration wanted to pass a bylaw on curfew on women. They were very worried about the increase in lewd behavior. So their fix of the problem is to keep women at home between certain hours. And we said, you know, how do you ensure that they don't commit lewd behavior between certain hours at home? You know, but the whole idea is it was just so silly that we organized, you know, a lot of women organizations from Jakarta and so on. There was a main pushback and it was defeated. But in other areas, you know, it's like, what is it? Poking a mole?
Whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole, you know. So the government, the central government has to make sure that the local bylaws do not contradict the higher laws or even the constitution. In some areas, they've been successful. In others, you know, as I said, you know, a lot of political parties are playing the Islamic politics, not necessarily substantively, but more instrumentally, you know, to gain votes. And I think, but in a number of areas, like the choice of wearing hijabs and so on, it's becoming a major fashion because Indonesia is now a new fashion center for Islamic, garment industries and so on. So a lot of people suddenly wear that. In my office, it's not necessarily reflective of a political choice. So it's more on and off, you know, depending, you know, what situations you are, and they wear them. Mm. So don't be too concerned only about appearance, but rather, you know, what is the content of the political behavior.
Hi, Ibu. My name is Rosa. I'm an MBA student from Macquarie. I'm an Indonesian, a big fan of you. I just have a fairly simple question. Who do you think gonna have better chance to win in this election?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question. Because we can read polls, but I remember I was asked to comment on the US elections and actually sitting the studio of CNN Indonesia looking at the votes counts, and before that looking at the debates, and I say, oh, Hillary had it. And then, you know, all the political scientists had eggs on our face, you know. We can only predict what happened. We cannot predict what's going to happen. But that is the true essence of democracy, you know, that the elections are not never necessarily, you know, presumed to be won, unless it is Golkar under the new order, and then we know that they would get about 73%. But now I say, you know, if the polls can be sustained, it is going to be pretty tight, because Kompas said that while it is still quite a two-digit lead, it's narrowing. And now they have got this several days of intensive campaign. Anything can happen. I can imagine black campaigns, door-to-door campaigns. You know, each side will intensify, you know, their campaigns. And apparently the numbers of undecided voters is about 13-14%. And that's, and it's quite a significant number. So, I will be watching it as closely as you.
Thank you, Ibu Dewi. Angus Grigg from the Financial Review. Can I ask you two questions? Firstly, we hear a lot about the sort of rising Indonesian middle class. How significant do you think they are as a voting bloc, and what sort of level of purchasing power have they got to? And secondly, just give us a little maybe sketch out, what do you think the main issues this election will be fought on?
Okay. Firstly, I'll answer the easy question. What are the issues? Indonesian elections are not about issues, as you know. I mean, nobody talks about issues. I mean, it's all about personalities. Although they debate about it, you know, it could be, it's a prepared draft that it could be exchanged. Sometimes in the elections debate is who's going to be much more nationalistic than others. But it is not going to be necessarily reflected in policies, because once you get into power, you are constrained by the realities of it. Even the most neo-libs will have to become protectionists, and the most protectionists will have to become much more outward-looking. You know, there's just a reality of the global structure of economics. So issues, they're not that important at the moment. In terms of, you know, the intolerance...
The middle class.
The middle class, they don't vote as a bloc. I mean, it is as diverse as a members of family. A lot of Indonesian families vote different ways, including in my family. I'm not sure how my husband would vote or how he voted. He never tells. In my aunt's family, the son in 2014 was a very active campaigner for Jokowi. My aunt was a devoted fan of Prabowo. Interesting conversation at the dinner tables. But we all agree that in media, WhatsApps, family groups, we should not talk about politics, but it's very difficult to avoid that. So the middle class is very, very diverse. But interestingly, the polls say that a lot of the Prabowo supporters are educated middle class. And a lot of the people in the rural area of the, you know, of the lower education, lower economic strata, mostly they voted for Jokowi. I think that's mostly because of this, you know, social welfare, you know, really pro-rakyat, pro-people, land certifications and things like that as well. While of course, you know, according to the polls, because Jokowi still has the higher one, most of the people from old age and education, clearly, you know, they prefer Jokowi, at least now. But a lot of the, you know, educated urban middle class, including the millennials, they like Prabowo. And one of the reasons is he's the gas firm. So this Make Indonesia Great Again resonates with a lot of them.
Good afternoon, Ibu Dewi. My name is Andrew Wanandi.
Good. Another Wanandi here.
I've got two questions for you.
Well, I think we have time for one, yeah, probably.
Maybe I'll just combine it to one. Yeah, basically. Yeah. Just recently there was an allegation that there was a flag for HDI, which is Hizbut Tahir, that was sort of like flag when Prabowo was doing his, you know, speech in Manado. I'm not sure whether it's true or not, but is it an issue for Indonesia if he became elected as a president? And also, as you know, HDI or Hizbut Tahir is not actually banned in Australia, and there was some allegation that they're still funding some, some sort of extremists in Indonesia. From that point of view, is that an issue for us, for Indonesia?
You mean Australians are funding Hizbut Tahir in Indonesia?
No, I mean there's some Hizbut Tahir is not actually banned in Australia at this stage.
Yeah,
and it's an issue.
Well, clearly there are always his concerns, but I'm a bit cynical in this. As I said, you know, the instrumental use of Islam. Who is using who? Because throughout the New Order period, the radical Islamic groups every so often will be used by the army, by the military, to fight one group against the other, you know. So this is very much the old operandi. So I'm not sure who is using who here. I hope that if Prabowo were to become president, you know, he would fight for what Indonesia stands for, i.e. Pancasila, you know, the pluralism, unity and diversity. Because if Indonesia doesn't hold on to that, there will not be much of Indonesia left. Yeah, because after all, you know, we are very diverse. I mean, what made Indonesia able to stay together as a nation, even before we talk about democracy and so on, you know, because of this willingness to coexist with each other. I mean, from Aceh to Papua, we have so many different identities, even within Islam. We have different schools of thought and so on. So if we only adhere to one interpretation of Islam, which is not the mainstream interpretation, you can imagine it will not go down well with the rest of Indonesians. So whoever wins in Indonesia, I hope that they fight for Indonesia and not for another country or for another system.
Okay, well, I think we're out of time now, but you're obviously welcome afterwards to come and talk to Ibu Dewi, who'll be sticking around for a bit. And before I let you go, a brief public service announcement stroke shameless plug. If you're interested in the elections and you saw the graphics that was being played as you came in on the election, some of the fantastic numbers and quirks of the system, you can check it out on our website at interactives.lowyinstitute.org. So do have a look at that if you have time. But please, for now, thank Ibu Dewi for sharing her thoughts with us today.